Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the Daily Objective, a very special edition of the Daily Objective. Today we have Chris Hattin. Excuse me, I tried to do this before and I did it better before. Hattinge, a South African who is a real expert on economic and foreign policy matters in South Africa. Chris is the executive director of the Center for Risk Analysis, CRA. With special focus on trade, investment, and economic matters, as well as foreign policy. Chris serves on the executive board of the Global Trade and Innovation Policy Alliance, sits on the Advisory Council of the Initiative for African Trade and Prosperity, and holds the position of Senior Fellow at African Liberty. Chris holds a Master's in Philosophy and Business Ethics degree from Stellenbosch University. In his role at CRA, Chris leads strategic engagements and briefings to clients across South Africa as well as globally. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today. The reason why we asked you to join us today is a news story that'll be provided in the links that South Africa has, the foreign minister of South Africa has officially stated that Jews who have gone to Israel to fight on behalf of Israel in the current conflict, should they return to South Africa, will be criminally prosecuted. The foreign minister not only said that they'd be criminally prosecuted, but that they could lose their citizenship. This appears to be part of South Africa's ongoing hostility to Israel and support, in effect, for Hamas, effective support for Hamas and Palestinian terrorists. Just to review the bidding a little bit, on October 7th, as viewers of Ayn Rand Center UK broadcasts know, we've covered this a couple of times, on October 7th, the South African government called for an immediate cessation of violence. Immediate cessation of, before Israel had done anything. And as we know, it took a while before Israel even did anything. But before a month had passed, by November 6th, I believe, they were withdrawing their the Israeli diplomats. By December, they were filing charges in the International Court of Justice. First, let me ask you, Chris, is it the policy of South Africa to just watch Israel get destroyed and let Hamas continue to do more October 7th? I mean, what would South Africa, in effect, be comfortable with in terms of an Israeli response to the atrocities of October 7th and ongoing violence there?
Thanks very much, James. Thank you for the opportunity to be on with you and to discuss South Africa's foreign policy, if we can call it that, at this point in time. If one wants to play devil's advocate, the rhetoric doesn't match the action. So the rhetoric is in terms of respecting human rights, individual rights, freedom of religion, freedom of expression, all those sorts of things, but then not in terms of action. So as you mentioned, around October 7th, last week, you had a vote in the UN around calls for a ceasefire. Part of that was the release of all hostages. China and Russia vetoed that particular resolution, and South Africa didn't, the South African government didn't comment that Russia and China had vetoed that particular resolution. So time after time, and playing devil's advocate here, trying to, you know, sort of strongman South Africa, the South African government's arguments, that the rhetoric hasn't matched action. So it's difficult to read in the specific motivations. You could have a combination of things. You could have trying to shore up domestic and international support before the elections, the national and provincial elections on the 29th of May, to distract from the South African government's own shortcomings. You've got unemployment, the unemployment rate over 40% on the expanded definition, youth unemployment rate over 70%, economic growth, if we're lucky, averaging between 1% to 2% GDP growth over the medium term. All of those things putting a lot of pressure on the current governing party, the African National Congress, and then trying to get whatever wins they can to get a few more votes domestically for those elections, but also internationally. Maybe trying to set themselves up post-election, trying to ascertain new sources of funding for party operations, all these things coming together where you put the South African government, I think, feels puts itself in a very difficult position to maintain its rhetorical stance on human rights, et cetera, but not practicing those when it comes to Israel, in terms of Israel asserting its sovereignty as a nation, in terms of defending its citizens from an aggressor force that invaded its country and its property. If you want to put it very diplomatically violated individual rights, human rights, the right to property, the right to life, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, the government isn't, it's sort of twisting itself in pretzels in difficult positions, I think, where it's trying to play to various forces. But at the end of the day, you see where the ultimate priorities lie.
So it's sort of pragmatism. The government finds itself in difficult economic and political situation. And so and it's facing a national election coming up here in just a couple of months. And so you'd be argue that for pragmatic purposes, they are basically trying to appeal to as broad an international group as possible, mouthing human rights on the one hand, and of course, acting like pro-Hamas, the legal arm, in effect, of Hamas. That's very interesting. Now, what do you think the chances are that Jews returning to South Africa would be prosecuted for having fought on behalf of Israel?
I don't see the enforcement thereof in terms of the sort of strong man portrayal or capable government portrayal that has been the case. And that's based on how things have gone in the last 10 to 15 years. So South Africa, the period 2008 to about 2021, 2022, the period of what we call state capture, so sort of wide-scale corruption, the hollowing out of state-owned companies, government departments. One can argue that's still continuing, and the ideological seeds for that were sown, I think, before 2008. So the sort of statist, collectivist policies and ideas, those were implemented beforehand. Though state capture to me was a necessary consequence of expanding the power of the government over the economy, over society. It wasn't an accident that state capture happened. And I see that still continuing. Under President Ramaphosa, the ANC has talked a big game around reform. It's been called the New Dawn, capacitating the National Prosecuting Authority, the police services, the intelligence services. But that hasn't been matched in terms of actual prosecutions of those who perpetrated things like state capture. So former President Jacob Zuma, who has now joined a new political party that is going to contest against the ANC in the elections, the Gupta family allegations around them and the influence that they exerted on President Zuma and the ANC around state capture. Those, the lack of enforcement and added to that, South Africa being placed on the grey list by the Financial Action Task Force last year, that's all around your ability to deal with money laundering and financing of terrorist activities, shows to me that there isn't necessarily the capacity of the intelligence and law enforcement agencies to push what they do and what they want to at least sell in terms of rhetoric. So that's not to say that they're not going to try their very best in terms of this kind of thing, because it might give them, again, that sort of rhetorical moral win in, from their point of view. And again, before the elections can show their voters, as well as undecided voters, see we're still the ANC or the government that we were beforehand. We still care about human rights around the world. We care for the oppressed. We were in exile during apartheid and the South African society under the National Party since 1948 up until 1994. So we're still what we were. So still support us and vote for us. But I don't think the enforcement capacity is there, number one, in terms of finances, but also in terms of sort of the capacity and the skills to enforce this kind of thing.
Right. There is a statute on the books in South Africa that says that you cannot go join a foreign army if you're a citizen in South Africa. On the other hand, there's been very little actual enforcement of that. Mm-hmm. I understand that Palestinian groups have been sort of ratting out, putting the dime on the names, naming South African Jews who go to Israel to fight for Israel, and that there have been earlier attempts at it, but there haven't been a lot of or any serious successful prosecutions in the past on this. And when it comes to South Africans going, say, to fight in the civil war in Congo, there really is no enforcement of the law, right?
Absolutely. And you can also ask questions around South Africans who might have gone to fight in or on behalf of Ukraine, where again, the South African government has sent, if you want to be kind, very mixed signals. Just today, the official X or Twitter account of President Ramaphosa, the presidency account, posted about a call that the president had between himself and Russian president. Again, if you want to be diplomatic, Russian dictator Vladimir Putin, how they wanted to talk about, how they discussed ending the conflict in Ukraine. So, using I guess, very mealy-mouthed words to shift around the moral issues to try and portray yourself in a positive light. But actually, it shows, if one wants to be kind, it's a pure case of pragmatism. I guess the worst case scenario, it's pursuing and getting closer to much more authoritarian, evil government.
Right. I mean, in the wake of October 7th, South Africa hosted leaders from Hamas, actual leaders of Hamas in the wake of October 7th, they hosted, as well as Fatah, as well as representatives from the Islamic Republic of Iran. So their attitude toward Russia and Iran suggests a sympathy for some of the worst governments in this world. Or would you put it again as pragmatist, a sort of slimy pragmatism, we're failing to acknowledge the dictatorial tendencies of those countries?
And part of that is that you've got this sort of idea of a separation between party and state, where the African National Congress is the majority party in the National Assembly. They've been the governing party of South Africa since 1994. Nationally, the only province of our nine provinces that is under opposition governance is the Western Cape, that is under the governance of the Democratic Alliance. But during those meetings with representatives from Hamas, for example, the ANC could say representatives of the ANC met with them, but not of the South African government, even though the ANC is the national government. So as you, I think, rightly point out, it's a way to engage in activities that you still want to, that you agree with morally, but you can then sell it as actually, you know, we're separating ourselves. It's at arm's length. We're respecting the objectivity or the neutrality of the South African government, but actually we're still the majority government. So it's quite an, I think, slimy way to try and get away with it.
Government itself, and that's a very interesting sort of distinction, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think we can see, though, where the ANC is coming from in their attitudes. But as you say, there's an election coming up. ANC has been in power, as you say, exclusively since there's been, in effect, a democratic South Africa. What do you think the outcome at the end of May is likely to be, or can we make a prediction at this point?
I mean, so as always with sort of polling, it's intended to be a bit of a snapshot of a given day, so not necessarily a prediction. We do our own polling. The latest polling we did was in October last year. Our own polling had the ANC coming in around between 45 and 47%. Other organizations are doing much more regular polling. So the latest of those that came out in March this year, organizations like the Brenthurst Foundation, the Social Research Foundation, all have the ANC between 40 and 45% and trending towards the 40% mark. So that means less access to your state resources, less access to patronage resources. I think that increases the tension within the ANC. The ANC is also part of the tripartite alliance, which includes the South African Communist Party, which is sort of the guiding light for the ANC in terms of ideology. That will increase tensions between those players in that alliance and again maybe exacerbate the worst tendencies. There's a possibility that the ANC goes into coalition with an entity like the Economic Freedom Fighters, which promises a lot more radical actions around property rights, expropriation without compensation. On the other hand, this then opens the possibility for opposition parties to really come in and take advantage of the decline of the ANC, which by 2029 could then accelerate. So things, it might be easy for me rhetorically to say things are sort of a bit on a knife edge or on the edge, but for the first time since 1994, and arguably since 1900, when you had the National Party dominating South Africa, then the ANC, where no singular political party is going to have sort of the rule of the roost, as it were. Now it just depends what positive actors or positive forces take some of those gaps being left by the ANC.
I see. Really, given the state of the economy and the sort of chaos that I've been hearing about in South Africa, I'm rather surprised that they're doing in the 40s. But it looks like, I mean, that's doing rather well considering what appears to be a crisis situation in South Africa. But nonetheless, if the opposing parties get a majority, and for the first time ANC gets less than majority, at least it's opening up the possibility that the ANC might someday not rule South Africa.
Yeah, 100%.
On this issue of foreigners fighting in armies, we have an article linked, which was referring to the South African foreign minister's threats to prosecute Jews who would fight for Israel. I have to say the article was misleading in several ways as it's comparing international law to this. It asserts that there's such a law as well in Great Britain. Now, it's true there's a statute from, I think, 1870, when Britain was trying to prevent people from joining up to help the French in the Franco-Prussian War, and so they passed a law. But that law itself has, in effect, never been prosecuted in Great Britain. Great Britain, famously, even before the 1870 law, Lord Byron, the famous poet, famously fought as a Greek freedom fighter against the Ottoman Empire. That's a very famous case. Other famous cases, a Spanish Civil War, Brits and Americans, the novelists Ernest Hemingway and John Dos Passos famously fought in the anti-Franco forces in the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, as did Brits. Just a few years ago, when Liz Truss was foreign minister, she said the government discouraged people to go fight for Ukraine in the invasion against Russia. There was never an intention on the part of the UK to prosecute people. So when they cite the United States and UK as having similar laws, the history is in fact against that. In the United States, we have a 150-year-old Supreme Court decision that says until and unless it's actually taking up arms against the United States, it's perfectly okay to go join. It's the foreign recruiters that we can, the foreign governments who might recruit in our country that we can prosecute under that law, not the folks who go fight. There's the French Foreign Legion. And there, of course, it was France recruiting foreigners to go help them in their conflicts in North Africa, very famously. But this idea that it's the norm or an international norm to prosecute people, your own nationals, for going off and fighting in a foreign war is rather unprecedented, and even in practice for South Africa.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. And I think it matches, again, the sort of desperation in terms of trying to set yourself apart. How do you differentiate your own, that you've got still the moral standing? What sort of footing do you have? And where your rhetoric doesn't match your actions. So if there's such a grand separation between what you're professing or what you're trying to say in your official position as, for example, the Minister of Justice or others, but also other sort of representatives of the governing ANC or the national government, but you don't match that with your actual enforcement day to day, then you start asking serious questions. And for example, in July of 2021, in the Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal provinces, so KwaZulu-Natal, more coastal on South Africa's east coast, the city of Durban, the biggest city in that province, you had wide-scale riots and looting around the jailing of former President Zuma and upset around that, et cetera, et cetera. There, the intelligence services, the police services were caught very much off guard. It took a few days to mobilize. You had communities having to arm themselves, deal with the rioting, the damage and looting of shops. If you can't even prepare adequately for that sort of scenario and show your citizens that you've got the capacity as the state, and I mean, your government is supposed to have the monopoly on force and enforce that. If you can't even do that, what does that do to your legitimacy and makes a bit more hollow your rhetoric when you say something like, we're going to arrest those who go and fight on behalf of Israel? So that isn't to say, again, that they can't try and put their best case forward and then actually get that capacity going, but the history is against them in that regard. The sort of burden of proof hasn't been shifted, I think.
So the foreign minister may just be issuing some hot air here for which there's really no ability to follow up with real prosecutions, much less removing people's actual citizenship. As I understand, there's a provision of the South African Constitution that says citizenship shouldn't be taken away. So they've got practical and legal problems. Given that, let me ask you this as well. Is there a constituency at all in South Africa that is sympathetic, you think, to the Israeli side? Will this issue play out? Normally, foreign policy isn't the driver of national elections. It's domestic right. issue. But nonetheless, do you think that there is a constituency within South Africa that would be sympathetic to Israel and objects to the ANC's position on this?
Absolutely. And here I would recommend going to look at the Brentos Foundation and some of their polling that they've done consistently over the years, their recent polling. And they've got a pretty good sample size. Their margin of error is around, but some of the polls is between 3 to 4%. I think that's your standard deviation, your standard margin of error. So it's a good snapshot, I think, of general just sort of state of the nation and your sort of zeitgeist of your citizenry. There's generally a leaning towards wanting to support positions around democracy, the rule of law, freedom of expression, human rights, that kind of thing. That could, of course, that can be abused by political actors who say, you know, positive rights are part of human rights. They don't focus on negative. The proper conception of human rights is negative, first order human rights, I think. But that being said, your average South African citizen respects things like safety, you know, your family stability, not upending everything, sort of a radical revolution overnight, which doesn't match with the rhetoric of some of your more left-leaning political parties like the ANC and the economic freedom fighters. And I think around South Africa's foreign policy, relationships with quote-unquote Western countries like the US, the UK, Israel, and others, there's generally, in terms of those Brentest polls, a leaning towards the view that South Africa should align with those countries. Those countries invest the most in South Africa. There's the most in terms of skill sharing, gross fixed capital formation, all those sorts of things. There's a realization, I think, of, again, this might be purely pragmatic, but if you want those beneficial relationships to continue, you need to act accordingly. You can't then act against those countries who are, of course, free to also choose their international partners, their trade partners. It's interesting that the rhetoric in some areas and avenues has been, you know, the US, there's a bill moving through Congress, a bipartisan bill, which is interesting in the current sort of US domestic political climate, that calls for a review of the US relationship with South Africa, specifically in terms of the recent moves by the South African government. If you as the South African government or those who support the government say the South African government can choose its international partners, absolutely rightly so. But so can the US, the UK, and other countries. They're free to choose based on their values, their interests, et cetera, et cetera. So don't then be surprised if those decisions then go against you. So I think there is definitely support for those relationships continuing amongst your average South African. It just remains to be seen whether South African citizens, when they go and vote, also realize foreign policy, geopolitics might become a bigger issue where it hasn't been that in the past.
And is it generally perceived, well, let me ask you just outright, is it generally perceived that closer relations with the United States and the United Kingdom would be more advantageous than closer relations with Russia and Iran?
I think there's an element of that realization, but that has to be maybe concretized and explained a bit more, where now the buzzword and the rhetoric is around things like BRICS and the expanded BRICS and the global South, and everyone needs a seat at the table at the UN, for example. The UN, the same body that, you know, pushes, that has Saudi Arabia as the chair of various organs and all that kind of thing. So what does that do for the
Rights Commission?
Yeah, what does that do for the legitimacy of the UN? That's a different question, I think. But yeah. I think if one can explain that to South African citizens, how if you want the continued benefits, the skill sharing, the technology sharing, the investments from countries like the US, the Netherlands, Germany, two of the biggest investors in South Africa. If you want those things, you need to pursue the accordant values and the accordant relationship. It's not a given that that'll always be there if you move yourself closer to countries like Iran and Russia and China.
Well, that's exactly it. I should think that given the conflict right now between most European countries and Russia, that your average South African would see greater advantage with heavy traders and investors in Africa, such as Germany and the Netherlands, as opposed to Russia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there is that realization on the part of your sort of average citizen. That isn't necessarily the case in terms of the current government, where it helps you in terms of your own maybe ego, but also in terms of the rhetoric you can use, you know, and I use ego in the very superficial sense. It's not supported by actually pursuing one's values and all that kind of, all the proper conception of egoism. But you can say you're part of the global south, you're at the table of BRICS, you've helped to expand BRICS that now includes countries like Iran and Saudi Arabia. It's you can sort of shore up your own feelings maybe of inadequacy, et cetera, by looking like a bigger player, where the previous iteration of BRICS with Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, I mean, talk about things like trade deficits. South Africa has a massive trade deficit with China, for example. We export a lot of raw materials to China. We import finished goods. We don't do beneficiation. We don't up our own manufacturing capacity, which you could expect if you don't have reliable and adequate electricity supply. So even within BRICS itself, if we want to put ourselves in a stronger position, are we really demanding those things from our trade partners in that bloc? Which in and of itself is a bit maybe sometimes of a non-concept. I mean, BRICS itself, there's no secretariat. There aren't bilateral tools within BRICS. It might be more of a rhetorical game than anything else.
I see. Daniel, do we have any super chats at this point?
We have a super chat from Bonnie. Thank you so much. A super chat from Steven. Thank you so much. And a super chat from Jonathan. Thank you so much.
So it's, yes, thank you very much, Super Chatters. You really are the great support behind Ayn Rand Center UK, and it is your support that makes all of this possible. So it sounds like it's not so much that South Africans are anti-Semitically hell-bent on the destruction of Israel, as we have a ruling party that is rather desperate and very pragmatic and friendly with the communists and are happy to take this anti-colonialist line and cozy up with Iran and Russia. That is what really explains what can, I think viewers of this channel will know my opinion on this, what amounts to a truly evil foreign policy with respect to Israel. Would you agree?
Yeah, not to maybe give a get out of jail free card on the sort of pragmatism point, but given the current governing party, the ANC, their history in exile, being very close with the former Soviet Union, getting that financial support, material support, but also in terms of ideology, morally getting that support. I think there are still actors within the alliance and the party who want to think those are the things they're still fighting for, against colonialism, against oppression, et cetera, but not taking cognizance of the current context and the current situation, where you've got one country in terms of respecting human rights, freedom of religion, freedom of expression in the form of Israel, versus fighting this force of Hamas that I think has been very open. I mean, that's not even trying to play devil's advocate, but has been open in terms of what they want to pursue.
And they can't even take a clear moral stance on whether or not Iran is an authoritarian theocracy or whether Putin is a dictator. That is for all the rhetoric about human rights. In Iran last year, people were executed for blasphemy. Women died in prison, disappeared when they didn't wear the hijab properly. And South Africa can't clearly call Iran a theocratic dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
That's rather shocking. That's rather shocking. But that is, I guess, where pragmatism leads. Do we have any more super chats, Daniel?
No more super chats, but we need to wrap up in a minute.
Well, I just want to thank you very much, Chris, for joining us. You bring some extraordinary insights into both foreign policy and economic matters in Africa that we don't normally have here. We hope to have people with your expertise on. I hope you would consider joining us again when we consider this, because this isn't going away anytime soon. South Africa is still pressing it in the Court of International Justice, whatever comes of their decision here. Where can people reach you if they want to contact you or get in touch with you and see what you guys are all about with African liberty and things like that?
Once again, James, thank you very much for the opportunity, for the work that you do, as well as the Ayn Rand Center UK. Don't underestimate the work that is being done to spread objectivist ideas and the work of Ayn Rand. You might not realize sort of who it reaches and the impact I think that it provides around the world. It might take a long time for the benefits to be seen, but I think it is that hard work is being done. In terms of the CRA and myself, I'm very active on X, on Facebook, and LinkedIn as well. You can find me there. You can follow the Center for Risk Analysis. We have local and international clients that we provide analysis to on South African issues, sub-Saharan Africa, global geopolitics, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to get in touch, any queries around South African policy, investment opportunities, all that sort of thing, we try and help paint a picture of the risk landscape, as it were. So please do be in touch. Any feedback, any suggestions, all that sort of thing, connections would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And starting in just seconds is the reality show, where we'll be talking about the dubious numbers of casualties that Hamas spreads and Western media outlets just spread. Continue to spread. So join us there in just seconds. Thank you again, Chris, and be well.